I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Today is the second half of our interview with Dayton Duncan, author along with Ken Burns of the book and PBS series Country Music. You can hear the first part of the interview on BoiseStatePublicRadio.org, our Reader's Corner app, or wherever you download your podcasts. Well, whether it's George Jones or Johnny Cash, Hank Williams, one of the things that comes abundantly clear in your film series and your book is that drugs and alcohol play a major role in the lives of so many of these country stars. I knew that, but I guess what I never really figured into it is the point you make in the film anyway about the travel schedule of these folks who are doing gigs every single night of the week, and when they're finished one night, it's get in the car and drive to the next place.
Yeah.
And it's either a drug to keep you awake or to put you to sleep, I guess, huh?
Yeah, I mean, that's another thing I was glad that we were able to get to in the film and into the book. We, you know, as fans, we hear a 3-minute song.
Yeah.
Well, we go to a 1.5-hour concert and we think, boy, that's an easy life. You write and sing a 3-minute song and you perform it, you know, perform a lot of them for a big adoring crowd, and that's a pretty nice life. But the reality, as I guess it was Ray Benson of Asleep at the Wheel told us, is that my band players say they don't get paid to play, they get paid to ride. Because you got to get from one concert to another. And particularly back in the 60s and late 50s, you know, you're driving, and many times not in a fancy tour bus, but in a car loaded with equipment and three other people. And you got to get from one concert to another, and the concert's over at 10:30, and somebody's going to drive, and you just hit the road. And in those days, amphetamines were not illegal originally. In fact, they were easily gotten from a friendly doctor who, not thinking that these things are going to kill you, but these are things that will keep you alert and keep you awake. And that's a handy thing to have if you're trying to get from Boise, Idaho to, you know, Casper, Wyoming the next day for an afternoon show. And you're probably not going to even get to a hotel. So that's a handy thing to do. And then the downers were to help you get to sleep once you get too wired. And so it wasn't really until finally the medical establishment realized what they were doing, and they became more tightly regulated. But by that point, a lot of people, like Johnny Cash in particular, but many others, Roger Miller, others, you know, were hooked and then could get into legal trouble. And then artists, as other drugs came on the scene, like cocaine, you know, a number of other artists, it's not exclusive to country musicians, it was true of many musicians, as we all know, became hooked on that too, or on the next thing, and then alcohol as well. You know, I think the point being is not to say if you're an artist, you will automatically, you know, be drawn to those things. Eddie Arnold never was. Many other artists weren't, but many were. And in that, they were not separate from other artists in other genres, nor were they separate from everyday people throughout the United States at that time.
Well, I plucked a number of backstories, I guess we could call them, that I'm sure very few people, even though they think they know the artist's music, ever heard until they have a chance to either read your book or watch the series. And I want to start with Johnny Cash visiting the Nixon White House and how he gave President Nixon a little bit of a surprise.
Yeah, I mean, Johnny Cash is probably the most towering figure in the film and the book. We introduce him in the fourth episode, and we end our story essentially when he dies. To me, he represents so much of what country music is and so much of who we are as Americans. He loved all forms of music. He invited Bob Dylan. He became friends of Bob Dylan. He would go give concerts in prisons. In fact, he sang a concert in San Quentin where a young inmate named Merle Haggard was sitting, who decided maybe that's a way out for me. is music. You know, he had a great heart for the underdog and the downtrodden and the left out, and he had a great affection for all sorts of music. And so he's a great example to follow in that. Mm-hmm. And in the late 60s or early 70s, he was, you know, hugely popular, had his own TV show and stuff. And he was invited to the Nixon White House. And as he arrived, he was told that President Nixon was making a special request that he sing a song called Welfare Cadillac. Welfare Cadillac was not a song that Johnny Cash had written, performed, or even liked, because it denigrated people on public assistance. And, you know, Johnny Cash grew up in a resettlement community in the New Deal, you know, that was a government program, and all his life had a special place in his heart for people who were having a tough time making it. So at the same time, he's this kid from Dyess, Arkansas, who's now going to be playing in the White House, and he's in a bit of a pickle. But he finally said, well, he wouldn't sing that song because it wasn't really one of his songs. So he'd, you know, do the other songs that, that the president had asked for that were famous ones of his. But then he, in place of Welfare Cadillac, he sang a song he'd written called What Is Truth? What Is Truth is like a full-throated cry and ratification of young people. And the lonely voice of youth cries, what is truth? And it defended them for the clothes they wore, the attitudes that they had, and for questioning the status quo.
And what they were doing right outside the White House.
and what some of them were, you know, I don't know if that, at that moment, but a lot of those people who were crying, what is truth, had recently been around the White House and taking over college campuses and demonstrating at the National Mall. So that's a classic. I mean, that is Johnny Cash at the core.
Yeah,
I mean, he went his own way, stood up for things that he believed in, and also was a great artist.
Yeah. Well, you really showed the empathy of the man, and I'd like to have you tell the rest of the story, because years and years later, he's doing this TV show, and guess who his guest is? It's Merle Haggard, who was in the audience years and years ago at San Quentin, and you can take it from there, but Johnny makes a request of Merle Haggard.
Yeah, well, you know, Merle did hard time in San Quentin, and after seeing Johnny Cash's show, he became a model prisoner and eventually got paroled, you know, used his talent to become a singing songwriting master, and was on his own great roll when he was coming to the Johnny Cash show. He was then, and when I interviewed him about a year before he died, still was, you know, somewhat ashamed of his prison record. And in the early parts of his career, he kept that secret. He didn't tell the fans. I mean, today, of course, you'd wear it like a badge of honor, you know. But in those days, he didn't want people to know that he'd been in prison. And he was telling Cash, said, you know, I saw you. It was the first time Cash learned about it. First time I saw you, I was sitting in the audience in San Quentin. And Cash said, you mean you were in prison? I didn't know that. He said, well, I haven't really let people know because I'm afraid it would hurt my career. And so Cash told him, according to Merle Haggard, so let me tell the people that. He goes, well, why would he want to do that? He said, you let me tell the people on national television, he said, and then those dirty magazines and, you know, tabloids, you don't have to worry about them anymore because it'd already be out. Mm-hmm. And so he did. And so on national television, he was about to sing this great song that he wrote in prison called Sing Me Back Home, which is about a prisoner on death row asking for this other inmate to come and sing him one last song before he's executed, Sing Me Back Home Before I Die. Before they sang that, Cash said, well, the first time that we were in the same place together, I was singing at San Quentin, and Merle was in the audience. And they sang Sing Me Back Home Before I Die, and Merle said, you know, he had a point. You know, might as well be truthful about it.
Yeah. Wow. You're listening to Dayton Duncan. He's the author, along with Ken Burns, of Country Music and Illustrated History, and also the 16-hour film series that just has played recently on PBS. Let's talk about Charlie Pride, an African-American who tries to break into a very white music situation in Nashville. I'd like you to talk about the role that Farron Young played in helping Charlie out in those early days, and you might even want to share with our listeners what Charlie had to go through, the first reaction or two from the crowds when he yeah. stood up there and people realized this wasn't our normal country singer.
Well, I mean, as we showed, the music itself was never segregated. But in a segregated society within country music, it became mostly white performers.
Yeah.
And as we show in our film and in the book, that didn't mean that only white people were listening to it. You know, African Americans were,
sure.
just as white kids were listening to so-called black music at the same time. And Charlie Pride was a sharecropper's son in the Mississippi Delta, and he grew up listening to the Grand Ole Opry. He loved Hank Williams, but he wanted a way out of being a sharecropper. And when Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier in baseball, he thought, maybe that's the way I do it. And he became a pitcher and played in the Negro League, still as a teenager, a pitcher, and then was in the minor leagues of pro baseball. He was up in Montana, of all places, Helena, playing for a team there, but also working in a smelter to help make some money. And at night, he would sing in a bar in Helena, Montana, and was singing a Hank Williams song, Lovesick Blues, when two people from the Grand Ole Opry had stopped by. And they, you know, if you've ever heard Charlie Pride's voice, you know that that is one extraordinary voice. Mm-hmm. And they encouraged him, if his baseball career didn't flower, that he ought to come to Nashville. And he didn't make it into the big leagues and showed up in Nashville to start recording. Well, you know, a maverick producer by the name of Cowboy Jack Clement heard his voice and said, well, let's record him. And as they're recording him, his agent said, you know, there's some people here in Nashville that you're going to have to get by, get past. And one of them is named Farron Young, who was known as one of the most outspoken and in certain cases more bigoted performers in Nashville. And Charlie said, well, let's go get it over with. Let's go meet him. And so they tracked him down at a night spot in Nashville, and Charlie just walked up to him and said, you know, Farron Young, I'm Charlie Pride. And and he said, I just want to say you sing a good song. And he said, well, I understand you do too. And they started trading songs there. And Farron Young, according to Charlie Pride, said, well, who'd have thought I'd be singing with a jig? But they started becoming friends. And when they're getting ready to try to get his records out, Chet Atkins, who was with RCA, decided to send the tapes to his bosses, but not tell them anything about who Charlie Pride was. And once they said, well, let's record him, he said, you know, showed him his picture. He was black. And they decided, well, he's so good, we're going to do it, but let's not send his photo or say anything about this when we release the first singles out to radio stations. So most of the radio stations were playing it, and most of the people listening to it assumed that it's just another Southern country singer, although one with a voice better than most country singers, and that they assumed he was white. And at one of his first concerts in Detroit, Ralph Emery, who was the MC and who we interviewed for our film and for the book, tells the story as to Charlie. He gets an introduction as he's one of the early acts, and Ralph said, how many of you are from the South, first, second, third generation? And most of the hands went up there in Detroit. He said, well, here's a guy from Sludge, Mississippi. Let's give a big welcome to Country Charlie Pride. And everybody had, because they'd heard the record, started cheering and clapping wildly. And he walked out, and as Charlie said, you could hear a pin drop. They were just stunned. And Charlie walked up to Mike and said, well, I know you're all probably a little bit surprised to see me standing here with this permanent tan, but let me sing you a song. And Lance launched into the song of the day, and he said halfway through they were clapping, and they he said they didn't care if I was green or pink. They liked what I was singing.
Right.
And so that's some of the things to his face. That, you know, and to continue the story, if I can, Farron Young was at a DJ convention shortly thereafter, and a DJ said, you know, we just learned that Charlie Pride is actually black. This is 1965, I think. And so our station managers decided we're going to pull all of his records from our station. And Farron Young looked at him and said, you tell that son of a bee that if he pulls Charlie Pride's records, he's going to have to pull all of mine, too.
Yeah.
So, you know, there you have it. The, you know, the artists could get to a place based on the art that doesn't distinguish between your skin color far in advance of the culture itself. They went into Farron Young and Charlie Pride went into the Hall of Fame at the same time. And Charlie said, then, you know, there we were, the two of us together, me and my best friend, Farron Young.
Yeah.
It's an incredible story.
Quite a story. Yeah. By the way, there's a local footnote to that here in Boise. You mentioned that he played baseball in Montana. We have a green belt, and every few feet along the green belt, there'll be a little display explaining the history of what happened along the green belt. And there was a minor league team here, and Charlie Pride played on that minor league team right here in Boise. So,
all right.
How about that?
Now I'm learning something from you. I didn't know the Boise connection.
Yeah, yeah. So let's talk about Loretta Lynn. You mentioned her earlier, and I'm sure Loretta Lynn never heard of the word feminist. Maybe she did later in her life, but certainly not when the song came out about the pill. Tell us about Loretta Lynn and the role she plays in country music.
Well, you know, she came from abject poverty in a holler in Kentucky, married as a teenager, had four kids before she was out of her teenage years. Her husband, you know, bought her a guitar, and she learned to play it and started making up songs for the kids and then singing in a nightclub. At that point, they were out in Washington State and recorded a song, I'm a Honky Tonk Girl, and they started sending it to radio stations and pretty soon ended up in Nashville. And in Nashville, as happened with a number of great artists, you know, they were trying to mold her into whatever was popular at the time. And they were having modest success, but not great success. And finally, her producer said, you should go back, write your own songs again, because you know what's going on. And so she wrote said, okay. And one of the early ones was Don't Come Home A-Drinkin' With Lovin' On Your Mind, which became her, I think, her first number one hit. This is at the same time that the organization that now, the National Organization of Women, was founded and the first time the word feminist was coined. And here she's got this song on country radio that is, you know, when you dissect that song, is Don't Come Home A-Drinkin' With Lovin' On Your Mind is about a woman's right to her own body, spousal abuse, alcoholism. And though she would not have used the word feminist, and neither would her fans, they realize, her fans did, women fans, that she was telling their story and speaking to them. And that's a great part of the connection that country music can create. In fact, Loretta told me that, you know, a lot of them, if their husband was coming home late drunk, they just put that record on, turn it up real loud. But that's just her. She's feisty and unfiltered, and she kept writing more songs like that. And then finally wrote this song called The Pill that her label, you know, held for 2 years. They thought it was too, you know, controversial. It's a woman saying, you know, for all these years, you've treated me like a chicken in a hen house, you know, creating one child after another. And while you go out and have all your fun and you've set this chicken one last time because now I've got the pill is how that goes. But they thought it was too controversial and held it for 2 years. When they finally brought it out, radio stations, many country stations wouldn't play it until there was enough backlash from fans, principally women fans, that finally brought it out. And it was a huge hit for her. And she said, you know, people would say, oh, well, it's another dirty song from Loretta. And she said, it wasn't dirty. You know, that's what was going on. And she said, in fact, if they'd had the pill when I was, you know, first got married, I would have eaten them like popcorn.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is Dayton Duncan, co-author of Country Music and Illustrated History.
I want to stay with Loretta Lynn, but bring Tammy Wynette into the conversation. And I'm thinking about a moment in the film series when you hand the mic over to Jeannie Seeley, who, by the way, I listened to on Willie's Roadhouse on Sunday mornings. She's on.
And she's terrific.
Yeah, she really is. So Jeannie Seeley is comparing contrasting the lives of Loretta Lynn and Tammy Wynette in regard to the song Stand By Your Man. Help us understand what was going on there.
Well, Jeannie is just a great artist, but also, you know, she's unfiltered too and a really strong woman of her own. She also told us, she said, you know, when they used to introduce women singers, they'd say, let's all give a good hand for this pretty little thing and make her feel welcome. The assumption being she's not really welcome, but let's at least make her feel that way.
Right.
But she was friends of Loretta and Tammy Wynette. And so she was comparing, you know, Tammy Wynette's great song about Stand By Your Man, which when it came out, she was breaking up with her second husband, with Loretta, who wrote songs like Don't Come Home a Drink of Lovin' on Your Mind, and also a song called Fist City about beating up anybody that tried to take her man and was always having fights with her husband Doolittle. And meanwhile, Tammy was going through multiple husbands, and Loretta stuck with hers. Said, you know, I always thought they each had been singing the other person's songs. But,
that's a great line.
She also was talking about the relationship of George Jones and Tammy Wynette and how troubled that was, George with his drinking and his substance abuse, and Tammy with her own problems and everything, and then two big, gigantic careers mixed in there for when they were married for a while. And she said, you know, I always thought this is not going to work, the two, but, you know, it may not work, but it's, you know, it's probably a great country song. And that certainly is the case with the two of them, Tammy and George. They did some great classics. We're Gonna Hold On was one of their big hits right about the time that they broke up.
Yeah, I think I read in your book that while Tammy Wynette was actually recording Stand By Your Man, her second husband was suing her for desertion.
Right.
There's a contradiction in terms if there ever was one.
Right.
Let's talk about what I think must be, and if he's not the most unlikely person to emerge in country music, he certainly comes in as an honorable mention. And that's Kris Kristofferson and his incredible background. And then you might even also talk a little bit about his songwriting because he worked for a lot of folks. But, boy, this guy has a very different background.
Yeah, it is very different, and it stands in stark relief to many of the stars who, you know, George Jones may have gone to a little bit of high school. Merle Haggard, I think, had a total of 6 or 7 days his freshman year in high school. That was it, and many others didn't even get into high school. But Kris grew up in Texas. His father was an officer, a colonel, I think, in the Air Force. And his family was well-read. He went to the prestigious college, Pomona College, one of the 5 colleges there in Southern California, where he played rugby and other sports, was a Golden Glove boxer. And then because he was so darn smart, he was a Rhodes Scholar. So he went to Oxford University and got an advanced degree in English literature. And when I interviewed him, about 6 years ago, he could still quote William Blake by memory. And he was an officer in the Army. He was had volunteered for service in Vietnam, but because of he was a Rhodes Scholar and he was a captain and could fly a helicopter, but the Army decided they wanted him to become an instructor at West Point. But he also had this love for music. And before he took the assignment to West Point, he wanted to go to Nashville and just see what that was like. And in his time in Nashville, the 2 or 3 days, he was taken to the Grand Ole Opry, saw Johnny Cash perform, met with Cowboy Jack Clement, the producer, and some songwriters, and decided, this is what I'm meant to do. And the passage that he quoted us from William Blake, the point of that long bit of intricate writing, basically the point is, you need to do what your heart tells you to do. And his heart was telling him he should be a songwriter. So he gave up the prestigious assignment to West Point, left the Army, went to Nashville, and started work as a janitor at Columbia Studios. And he would pester songwriters about how they did their stuff, and he would sometimes try to slip songs to artists, including Johnny Cash, who they all sort of studiously avoided the janitor with the songs in his pocket. He got a letter from his mom after a couple of years that basically said, you're no longer a member of our family. We're ashamed and embarrassed by what you're doing, trying to become a country songwriter. I mean, that's just trash. And if you're going to continue doing that, please don't come home and please don't bother us anymore. And he showed that letter to Cowboy Jack Clement, who was a friend of his. And Jack said, oh, you got to let me show that to Johnny Cash, because Johnny Cash had his own troubled relationship with his father, particularly. And so he showed it to Cash, and Christopherson was in there, you know, cleaning out ashtrays and sweeping the floor one day in Columbia Studios. And he said, and Johnny Cash came up to him and said, Chris, always nice to get a letter from home, isn't it? And laughed, but then took him under his wing. And all of his recording sessions were always closed to other people. But he said, you know, bring that kid that's a janitor, let him sit in on the sessions. And under his wing and others, and particularly because of the brilliance of his songwriting, he became what he became. And, I consider Sunday Morning Coming Down as probably one of the greatest country songs ever written. Mm-hmm. It's just, to me, astonishing poetry. And, you know, if you study poetry, you can see the influence of his study on his writing, the use of alliteration and other things, the beauty of the poetry. And also, Chris started writing songs, you know, Help Me Make It Through the Night, For the Good Times, other things that dealt with the relations between men and women a little more directly, though very poetically, than most country songs had up to that point. As one of the people in our film says, that we interviewed Hazel Smith, said, you know, up to that point it was, oh, can I kiss you on the cheek, little darling? Mm-hmm. And he's talking about take the ribbons from your hair, you know, and everybody knew what he was talking about. And so he's just this great, I think, you know, you compare him and Hank Williams, who came from a totally different background, you know, hard scrabble, out of school early, could not even read musical notations, and became, and rightly so, dubbed the Hillbilly Shakespeare. And somebody that Kris Kristofferson, with an advanced degree in English literature, admired. Mm-hmm. But what they each could do is to write these songs that just take you to a different place and remind you of who you are and talk about emotions and things that have happened that you can then say, oh, I'm not alone, am I? You know, I've been through that too. They're telling my story. They somehow knew what I had just gone through. And that is genius, and that is great art.
Mm-hmm. Do we know if Christofferson's mother ever got over the fact that he chose a career they didn't have planned for him?
My understanding is that she did not. Hmm. I think his father eventually made something of a rapprochement with him, at least saying after he was successful and everything that, you know, he was glad that he had done so well with the path that he had chosen. But that's, you know, that's hard stuff.
Dayton Duncan, you have been very generous with your time. I can't thank you enough for country music and illustrated history and the film series on PBS. It's been a delight talking with you about what has clearly become a love of yours and a love of ours. Anybody who has read the book or watched the film series, and if you haven't, you got to get out and buy that book and sit down sometime and watch the PBS series. Dayton, thanks a lot for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Oh, well, thank you for having me.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research and production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Custra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that shape our world here at Reader's Corner.